the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
Orson Swindle was a young Marine officer who flew more than 200 missions over Vietnam in his F-8E Crusader. On Veterans Day, November 11, 1966, then-Captain Swindle's plane was shot down over North Vietnam. It was his last scheduled flight before returning home. Captured by the North Vietnamese, he spent more than 6 years being transferred between various prison camps, including the notorious Hanoi Hilton complex. During part of his captivity, he shared a cell with a United States naval officer by the name of John McCain. In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, Lieutenant Colonel Swindle sits down with guest hosts Taylor Keelan and Reagan Wilson to recount his experience in Vietnam, his time as a POW, and the many blessings he has enjoyed since his return home.
As I recall in some of the discussions I've had with you, Orson, you were raised by your grandparents, specifically your grandmother.
Right, my grandmother. My grandfather passed away shortly at the end of the war, after the end of the war.
Why were you raised by your grandparents instead of your parents?
It was pretty much a choice of my own at 8 or 9 years old. I was born in 37. I remember vividly the war. My father was a Marine, made the landing on Iwo Jima and survived it. But he and my mother divorced during the latter stages of the war. And when my father came home from the war, they had a discussion and presented me with the option of, well, they're going to get divorced. Who do they want to live with? And I said, well, I think I'll live with my grandmother because I'm not leaving Camilla. So it was a fortuitous decision because my mother and father both had rather tragic lives, and I was raised by this solid matriarch of the family who taught me discipline and integrity and courage, and she didn't quite beat my brains enough to make me do good at Georgia Tech when I went out to school, but she had a heck of an impact on my life.
And I'm sorry you decided Tech. Yeah. My mother went to Georgia, which I thought was a finer institution, but how did you decide Tech?
Like all kids that are boys who are interested in football, we have teams. And when I was growing up at 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, Bobby Dodd and Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets got on a roll and went 33 games without a loss. And so I was pretty much a Georgia Tech fan. But I also, at that time, Sputnik had just been launched. And, we talked about the technology gap that we had. I think it was called something else, but that's essentially what it was. So there's a lot of impetus and encouragement to go off to engineering schools. And Georgia Tech, I'm homegrown, so the tuition would be a heck of a lot less, and my grandmother and I didn't have any money. And that was the decision. And while I had a difficult time going through, and if I look back on it today, I probably couldn't get into the school, and I know I couldn't get out of the school, but I managed to survive. And it's one of the great things in my life. I treasure it dearly.
You decided to go into the Marine Corps. Did you choose the military because most of your peers were going into the military? And if so, what made you choose the Marines over other services?
Well, to answer that part, my father had been a Marine. Iwo Jima, I was vividly aware of World War II and the Marines' role, and, of course, following the little maps in the newspapers every day and so forth. With that background, and then two of my fraternity brothers were senior ROTC, senior ROTC, I guess is what they called it, and they were Marine option. And I was very close to them, and they had an influence on me. And back in those days, taking ROTC for 2 years was mandatory at Georgia Tech and, I guess, schools across the country. So we all had a taste of it. I didn't particularly like ROTC and opted to go through the Marine PLC program, which is a summer program. I went the summer of my sophomore and junior years and was commissioned shortly after graduating from Tech in 1959. And quite frankly, the job markets weren't too bright then. I had no idea what I wanted to do in life. I said, well, let's go into the Marine Corps.
That always helps with recruiting.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you were pretty heavily influenced by your father, even though you said that your relationship with them was maybe a little strained.
It was a short relationship, to put it in another way, and that's not to mean I saw my father frequently after that, but I didn't see my mother but twice before she passed away when I first came in the Marine Corps. But I think more than my father, it was just the evolution of World War II and being exposed to it, being aware of it. And, you know, we all as kids find things to look up to. And as boys in those days, we did a lot of playing with toy soldiers and things of that nature. So being a Marine was just a thing to do.
Why aviation?
With all due respect to my infantry friends, it's a better ride. I didn't go into aviation until 2 years after I was in the Marine Corps. I was at Beaufort Air Station, Marine Corps Air Station, Beaufort, South Carolina, and all my neighbors were flying F-8s, and I was just sitting there seeing them take off every day, and it's pretty good. I think I'd like to do that. So with a little bit of encouragement from them, I went to flight school. A number of them didn't come around to visit with me when I came home for fear I'd blame them for what happened to me, but they're a great bunch.
How did you like flying the F-8? I was doing a little research before the show on the Crusader, and I guess in the Navy it had a reputation for being what they called an ensign killer, and it had a higher mishap rate apparently than the F-4, difficult carrier landings. But that was the Navy side of it. What was its reputation in the Marines?
Probably worse.
Okay.
No, I just read some statistics, and I can't quote them exactly, but something on order of there were 1,300 F-8s built, and 1,115 of them were involved in accidents.
So, oh my gosh!
So you had to fly the airplane, and I read something also in this same report that said the Marines only sent their very best F-8s. I'm living proof that it was not the case. But it was a great airplane, and it was the hot airplane of our times. You know, the F-4 was just – we got our F-4s after I went through flight school, and we're just getting ready to go to Vietnam when the first F-4 squadron in the Marine Corps was located at Beaufort. That was an impressive airplane, to say the least, and would become more impressive as war came on. But the F-8 was just the fast, speedy, sleek, good-looking airplane that a lot of us like to fly. But I also flew the A-4, which in its day was incomparable. It's a great airplane also.
What did you like about flying? Is there anything that really stood out to you?
No, it's just it's hard to say. You know, we're all little boys, and it was a marvelously beautiful thing to do. It was exciting. It was demanding, obviously. And as far as I was concerned, it was just something that I had nothing in my background. I didn't make model airplanes when I was a kid. I didn't have anybody in my family that flew. So just out of the clear blue, I said, I think I'll go try to fly airplanes. And I had a difficult time getting through flight school, you know, a couple of downs. And we all struggle because it's learning a whole new skill. But it was just a great thing to do. And the fraternity of fighter pilots and attack pilots. We Marines and Navy make a difference. Fighter and attack, the Air Force, you're either fighter pilot or, you fly one of those things with lots of motors and big wings and so forth. And, of course, in the Marine Corps, we have our helicopter friends, too. But it's a great fraternity to be in. We all have enormous egos, and we love life, and we love the high speed of it.
Now, you're in this F-8. You're flying out of Da Nang.
Yep.
And you've flown over 200 missions, and you're like, wow, last mission, finally. Mission 205. And something happens on that mission, and if I were you, I'd just be like, God, really? Are you kidding?
Well, more than waking up that way, it was actually, I had been out of the squadron for several months. I was over at the wing headquarters flying missions with my old squadron before they leave country. And they leave country on November the 15th, and November the 11th is the last day I'll be able to fly with them because of duty restrictions. And I had the duty on November the 10th all night long, which is the Marine Corps' birthday, and we always have very large parties when we have the Marine Corps anniversary and celebrate our great heritage. And I couldn't go to the party, so I was in fairly decent shape the next morning, even though I hadn't slept. And I actually went back after I was relieved of duty. I went back and slept for about 5 hours. And when I woke up, I went back through my office, the bubble, where we kept track of missions and assigned missions. And I was told that they just shot two F-4s down in the target area I was going to. And my former squadron commander, who is now my boss in the G3 section operations, said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to fly what will have to be my last mission. He said, well, damn it, you shouldn't be flying them. He said, I'll be glad when you get through with this. You've flown enough. And I said, I'll be okay, Skipper. And I went over and got shot down.
Wow.
It's irony galore.
Now, when you were incarcerated, there's actually a couple of anecdotes I've heard about over the years about Orson in prison. And one of the ones I really enjoyed has to do with a stool and a prolonged period of time spent on the stool. Can you elaborate?
Well, in the summer of 69, the Vietnamese were in a really foul humor. I was with about 55 POWs out at Sante Camp, which would become famous for the raid that the Sante Raiders and made on the camp to try to rescue us. And a little later that year, we'd been pounding them pretty hard, and they dragged me in for an interrogation, and I wouldn't give them answers, so they chained me to a stool or wired me to a stool. They had leg irons, and they wrapped wires around, and so I couldn't get off the stool, and they kept me awake all night. And it went on for, I am told, and I can't say that this is accurate because I became I was hallucinating my leg mad, but supposedly 10 days. And then I went sort of nuts from the lack of sleep, and I don't know whether it scared them or they just figured they couldn't get anything rational out of me at that point in time, so they let me sleep for about a day and a half. And then the next thing I know, they've let me sleep, and then they come back and I say, surely you will write letters of apology. And I said, no, I'm not writing letters of apology. So I go back on the stool, and we go through the same game before. And again, I'm told it was another 10 days, but I still, in my own mind, I find it hard to believe. But I'll take the word of those who are more aware of things than I was at that point in time. And I finally broke down, and they made me write a confession. But John McCain relates in one of his books, one of our fellow POWs at Sante was taken out a day or so after I was taken off the stool, put in the same position, and he apparently didn't last but about a day and a half. And when he was leaving the interrogation room, he supposedly tells a story that you're no Swindle. So, I don't know. You've heard of a hard-ass Marine. Well, I guess I was one. But
when Veterans Chronicles returns, Lieutenant Colonel Swindle recalls his emotional return home.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. After being held prisoner for more than 6 years, Orson Swindle, along with his fellow POWs, would finally be given back their freedom.
Well, you returned and one of the first groups of POWs to come
home.
Their homecoming was staggered over several months. What kinds of feelings and emotions were running through you when you actually touched down on American soil?
Well, it's a series of things. Let me go back a little bit if I've got a few minutes here and sort of set the stage. We're in what we call the Hanoi Hilton. We were in a big cell with about 25 of us. There, Bud Day and John McCain and Jimmy Bell and Jim Warner. No, Jim Warner was not with us at the time, but a number of us. And they come in one night, and the guards come in the room, and we all have to stand up, and they tell us to start rolling up our gear. But they start calling off names. This is in January of 73. We had just experienced the Hanoi bombing. But anyway, we recognized by the names. We all knew when we were shot down, and we noticed they were segregating us by time of shoot down. So that was a good sign to us. We thought that with the bombing, here they are segregating us by shoot down date, that we were likely coming home. And then I was in the second group. We were released on the 4th of March, supposed to have been the 3rd of March, but they were played games and kept us an extra day. And we had seen films of the French when they were released from the Vietnamese, all jumping up and down and hugging each other and showing all this emotion. And we said, no, because the camera's always rolling. We said, no way do we give them any satisfaction. We go out and look upon them with total disdain because they were really despicable people. I can't begin to elaborate on that enough. And so we very stoically received the clothes that we would come home in. We were taken, we literally got in a small formation, and we walked outside the prison, first time we'd ever traveled outside the prison without blindfolds. We got on a bus, and there were thousands of people standing around. And we were driven across the city to the airport there, and we parked behind a big metal building. And we were there out of the sight of people, and then looking off in the distance is this C-141 coming in. It was the most that it was just overcome with excitement and sadness and every emotion known to man. And then that airplane, we could just see over the building now when it landed, and that big tail with the American flag on it taxied over real close to us. Then we were marched up, and we were our names were called. We were turned over to an Air Force general, General Hogan, and a young lieutenant by the name of Terry Sylvester escorted me out to the airplane. And interestingly, as I approached it, an Air Force colonel at the bottom of the ramp said, "Are you the Marine?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, there's a friend of yours up there." And my old dear friend, Jim Harrison, who had been with me back at Buford and had given my former wife his set of wings to give me when I got my wings, he was there waiting on me. And then we start this very quick trip back to the States to rejoin our families. And, you know, every emotion known to man, I mean, a lot of us had no wives and family when we got home. They had separated and divorced, and some had passed away. And, you know, I was lucky my former wife was there and my son was there. And I talked to him on the phone from Clark Air Force Base, and then we flew from Clark to Texas, Lackland Air Force Base, and then on into Jacksonville, and I would see my wife and son for the first time in over 7 years. That's pretty emotional. And the problem of readjustment was difficult for each and every one of us for all sorts of different reasons, the personalities, the circumstances. Some of the wives didn't even know their husbands were alive. My family didn't know I was alive for almost 3.5, 4 years. I would presume captured, but, you know, a lot of uncertainty. So it was an emotional roller coaster, to say the least.
Your return was one of the few bright spots in the Vietnam War. I mean, you were treated like celebrities mm-hmm. when you returned. And I'm wondering if that has led to so many of you all being catapulted into the long-term spotlight. And what I mean by that is that I've noticed a number of the former Vietnam POWs have been appointed or run for and been elected to office, including you. You ran for Congress in Hawaii twice, mm-hmm. am I right?
That's correct.
Do you think that celebrity status that you attained upon coming home played any role?
Well, I have, you know, being in public light, I mean, one of the first things that happened to us when we came home is the huge throngs of people waiting for us.
Right.
I came home to Jacksonville, Florida, and I remember Danny Glenn, the lieutenant commander in the Navy, and I were the only two POWs on the plane that came to Jacksonville. We let some others off at Brooklyn Air Force Base, as I recall. And there were 10,000 people out there, just a huge crowd of people. Right. And we're immediate celebrity, and we're in the spot. And we're driving out in town at night. There were billboards up in front of the Holiday Inn, "Welcome home, Orson and Danny," and, you know, and newspapers and everything. And we were immediately asked to start speaking. So we were really exposed. And one of the most disheartening things we heard, I think, I don't know, I can speak for everybody, but the vast majority, it was odd to us. I mean, we're the prisoners. But people said, "You're the only heroes of the war." And that's nonsense. You know, the guys who fought and right. died were the heroes. We're just the victims. You know, we just didn't get away. We were unlucky, but not as unlucky as many, a huge number. But I think the thing that drove so many of us to public service was we sat there for 5 and 6 and 7, and in the case of Everett Alvarez, 8 years, and Floyd Thompson, almost 9 years, waiting on the political leadership of this country to make up its mind to win the damn war or admit that it's defeated and get the hell out.
Right.
Because it was just insanity to fight that war the way we fought it. It like we didn't really want to win, and that just infuriated us. And we sat there, and we were frustrated. I remember pacing back and forth, listening to the propaganda, and just getting angry as hell, knowing the propaganda's garbage, But just realizing we're sitting in jail year after year after year, we can't do a thing to help. It said when we get out, we're never going to be complacent about freedom and the beauty of our country if it's run right and having the right kind of people in office. And sadly, we're still working on trying to get the right kind of people in office, I must say.
Orson Swindle shares more about his career in politics when Veterans Chronicles return.
This is the Radio America Network.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
We remember 24 hours a day.
We study the news and history.
We assemble information. We speak out.
And we listen to you.
And we don't forget that every pleasant minute of this freedom we owe to those who defend it.
So, here's to life.
The freedom of conscience.
And liberty.
Thank God Almighty.
And the pursuit of happiness.
A decorated pilot who was shot down during what was scheduled to be his final mission over North Vietnam, Orson Swindle leaned on his fellow prisoners of war for support throughout their ordeal. For many, their captivity only strengthened their will. Many, including Swindle, would go on to successful careers in business, politics, and the military. As our story concludes, Orson Swindle talks about life and politics, as well as his own personal influences.
She did run, as Taylor said, in 94 and 96.
Mm-hmm.
In Hawaii. How did you end up in Hawaii?
I got married. My future wife, Angie, and I got married in December of 1989. I better get that right. She had been living out there for quite some time, and I had gone through a divorce the previous year, and I was just leaving the Reagan administration, and it seemed like a reasonable place to go. And I got out there, and I said, oh, my God, this is worse than some of the places I've been in Georgia where it's just one-party rule. And I was encouraging young people to get out and run for office, you know, because you got to start. You got to get active and do something. And they were saying, well, no way to win. And finally, somebody said, well, why don't you run? And I said, that's an insane idea. And the next thing I know, I've agreed to do it. And it's not something that I particularly enjoyed, but we did rather well for only about a three-month campaign in the first time against Congressman Neil Abercrombie. But I ran a second time, and we got, if I remember correctly, Neil beat me by about 8,000 votes, 50% to 47%. So, you know.
It's not much.
But that was close enough, and I wasn't willing to try it again.
You held him to 50%.
He'd been getting about 70%, so we did okay.
Briefly, what's it like? So few people have any idea what it's like to be a POW. Likewise, very few people have any idea what it's like to run for Congress and to be their party's nominee.
Both of them can be described with one word, insanity. Because often said being a POW is a good training for running for political office. But, you know, we got to have good people run for political office. It is a strain. And obviously today raising money is the guts of it. And that's, to me, a very unnatural act. And it makes it unpleasant. You know, it's just too much money washing around, as John McCain would say.
Speaking of McCain, you have a very unique perspective on the guy. Yeah, you went from sharing a cell with him to watching him become this media megastar. And, of course, the Republican nominee in 2008 for president. How has he changed?
Oh, as I see him, which has to be different from the average person, I don't honestly see a lot of change. I know him really personal. He is extremely smart. He has a great love and affection for this country and our system. His family is a family of patriots. They've been serving since Washington time. And he is very intense. He is also a very tolerant person of different points of view. He doesn't mind being disagreed with. Betrayed is something else, as we all will take offense to being betrayed. He's more patient, I think, than perhaps we were, and I am too, when we were young. But he remains one of my heroes. I don't agree with him all the time, but I have never questioned his good intentions.
I've heard him say he's under no illusions that he has true friends on Capitol Hill. And he said at this time that he recognizes that when he does leave office and the trappings of that office are no longer with him, that his true friends always have been and will continue to be those with whom he served in the military.
I think that's true, and I think most political figures, if they should listen to him, because I think it's true for all of them, too. He uses Harry Truman's expression, if you want a friend in Washington, D.C., get a dog. But, you know, his friends will always be there with him. And like I said, most of us disagree with John on different points. But it doesn't make any difference. He is an incredible patriot. He is courageous. He is honorable. He did a magnificent job in prison under terrible circumstances. You know, he was almost dead. Mm-hmm. They'd given up on him. They thought he was going to die. And he came back. He's a fighter, and he always will come back. And when he retires, I think he will move on to bigger and better things. Even I think he will become a world spokesman on security matters. He is brilliant in national security issues. He knows the system. He knows the threats. He understands the problems. He understands what it takes to win. And unfortunately, there are not enough like him in the U.S. Senate or in the Congress to make this country safer than it is.
You've remained one of the most politically active of the POWs over time. Some have dabbled in political activity over time, but you have consistently been active in campaigns over the last two decades or more. What's your opinion, really, on the role that veterans do and can play in the political process? And what experience do they bring to the table that is unique, other than the sheer fact that they wore the uniform?
Well, that fact alone makes them unique in our society. Those who have witnessed and survived combat even have a more unique perspective on it. We have a lot to give back to the country if only we will. And I say that because, first off, most military, especially career people, are taught, and it's part of the process, I mean, it's part of the culture, we're not political. We stay out of politics. We're not permitted to be political. We can participate in politics. We just can't do it visibly as a member of the armed services. So there's a reluctance for most veterans. I'm using big, broad terms, but I think I'm probably right on that. Most veterans to get involved in politics at all. They take a disinterest. They look upon political figures with disdain. Perhaps some driven by experiences like mine, which we were so frustrated with our political leadership, it drove me to want to get involved and make a difference and change it. And I think not enough of our veterans get involved to change it to a better system. We have a magnificent system, this democracy of ours, but it takes informed participants. People who go out and vote on emotion are not necessarily informed, and they do make tragic mistakes. Veterans, because of the uniqueness of their experience, could be a potent force in politics. But the key thing to know about veterans is they're not monolithic. They're not all of one persuasion. They're any man. I mean, they're just a cross-section of the country. Now, you get narrow it down to a group like us POWs or the people who are in the intensity of warfare, they might be a little more anchored in other belief systems that they aren't a cross-section so much. They tend to be one side or the other of the political spectrum, conservative. They'll be more conservative, I think. So, you know, they can play a role, and unfortunately not enough do, and even more, and put a footnote on that. And our voting system is, in my opinion, so screwed up as to often make it impossible for active duty service people to get their ballots in time to vote. And that's not by accident. I think there's an intentional effort throughout the country by political structures within states, which are controlled by politics, to make sure that absentee ballots don't always make it back to be counted. And that's been a problem for decades.
Yeah, the absentee ballot problem has been an issue for a long time, in the 90s and the 80s. And then in the 80s is when you got into the Reagan administration as the Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Economic Development. Now, what about your background prepared you for that? How did you get into that?
Well, I had heard a term when I was a young kid called the term patronage, but I didn't really pay any attention to that. In 1980, I had met President Reagan when he was governor. Actually, yeah, he was still governor, and then he was not governor, and he came to some of our POW reunions, and I really liked this man. And I remember him from my earlier years as being a movie star, but I got to meet him and talk to him and talk to Nancy, and I was just so impressed with the way when he talked to you and a group of people, you always thought he was talking to you. His speeches were the same way. When he gave a speech to the nation, I always got the impression he was just talking to me. Hey, he had that kind of communication skill. And when I retired from the Marine Corps, the first thing I did was call a good friend of mine who was working for Mrs. Reagan and said, I'd like to help the governor run for president. And I was put in touch with the leader of the party, Reagan campaign team in Georgia, and he and I became lifelong friends. And I worked on the campaign and helped organize a district and did all the things you have to do in party politics to help get people elected. And then, lo and behold, he won. which may be the last candidate I supported who won, if I'm not mistaken. I was thrilled and said, let's go to the convention. I went to the convention and I was thrilled and we had a great time and we partied hard and we were happy for the country. It was a new day in America. And all of a sudden, one day, I get a call and said, President's team in Washington would like you to consider taking a political appointment. I had no idea. You know, it was not in my thought process.
Who, me?
Yeah. And it was not something I desired. And I was asked to take a position running a financial assistance agency for agriculture in Georgia, which I did for 4 years. And I came up to Washington as Assistant Secretary of Commerce. Very turbulent career.
Did you like it, though? I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's great.
It's also how you met your wife, isn't it?
I met my current wife.
Yeah. Yes.
I grew up with my first wife, but I met Angie the latter part of my political career with the Reagan administration. It's a very rewarding experience. I enjoyed it immensely, and I later would come back to Washington as a commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission, which was altogether a different kind of political job. But that, too, that's probably the best job I ever had. I really enjoyed it.
What initiatives that you instigated at the Federal Trade Commission stand out for you during the – how many years?
Six years? 7 years. No particular commissioner instigates any particular thing, but we all do it collectively. There are no more than three can be a one party, and the party in White House usually has a majority. And one of the things that we did, which I was particularly fond of, and we got more praise, just interesting little stories about the appreciation of the public – we started the Do Not Call program. That was a marvelous success. A lot of our employees go out and jog during lunch hour, and they had an FTC T-shirt on, and people would honk their horns at them and say, thank you for Do Not Call, which that was good. And we dealt, when I was there, we were right in the heyday of the great merger wave that was going on, and dealing with mergers of high-tech companies and oil companies. And of course, the other side of the mission there is the consumer protection things and dealing with information security and privacy, which I got very much involved in that.
And since leaving the FTC, what kind of work have you been involved in other than campaigns, which we know you're very
involved
well,
in campaigns? Well, I was associated with a large law firm here in Washington as a senior policy advisor on information security and privacy policy, and I did that for several years. And last summer, a year ago, I just decided I'd worked hard enough. Long enough. I've been working since I was 16 years old, and, you know, some of it some long hours. And I said, you know, that's enough. But I stay involved. I can't imagine just walking away from staying active in life, and part of it's politics. And I still have that burning desire to see better people in Congress. I had hoped one time I might be one. I didn't make it, but I have helped others who aspire to do the same thing try to get elected. And we keep struggling and we keep fighting because we're losing ground. Our country is being transformed right before our very eyes. And if we don't stop what's going on, our children and grandchildren will not live the same lives that I lived. I've had a great life, a lot of hardship, but a lot of highs and wonderful people along the way. But I don't know that our children will have that luxury.
What do you see as your legacy? How would you like to be remembered?
He was a good guy and he cared about people.
You'd like that to be your epitaph?
Yeah. He's a good guy and care about people. And I really do. I just, if you have the opportunity to help somebody else along the way, you make a difference in people's lives. And I'm not saying I'm a saint or I've made all that much difference, but I like to think I've made that much difference that you help people along the way because I got some help along the way. You know, we're a product of the environment we grow up in, and some of us grow up with a little adversity and it affects our lives forever, and others have a cakewalk, and then all of a sudden we all run into calamity, and how you get through those depends a lot on who influenced you along the way. In my case, you know, football coaches and teachers and the parents of friends and leaders that I have worked with. And Taylor, you and I have talked about leadership. And, boy, I learned so much from so many people that were my seniors and also contemporaries. So it's just being around here is great because there are a lot of interesting personalities. But I'm nothing special. I just play the hand that was dealt me.
You said there's a lot of interesting personalities. I just had to ask you, is there one really that stands out to you, living or dead, with whom you've been in touch?
With whom I've been in touch?
Yeah.
My grandmother was pretty interesting. I had a great aunt who was an educator who was just remarkable. She taught me to love books and read and mm-hmm. be curious about things and just don't follow the pattern that somebody laid out for you and, you know, think for yourself and make your own decisions and always mm-hmm. saying, be good. You know, don't do things stupidly and wrong, but they certainly were two interesting figures, but that's family. But in public life, President Reagan, I had the privilege of meeting him on a number of occasions, and he was always impressive. But the most impressive people I've ever known were some of the people I was in prison with. I mean, they just were remarkable people, and we're close friends even today. Leo Thorsness and John McCain and Bud Day and I could go on and on because the list is long, but they're just remarkable people. And each one, you know, people are rather amazed that we survived the prison thing. They like to hear that and, you know, the war stories. And I keep telling them, I said, you know, those are interesting stories, but the biggest story is what we did with our lives after we came home. We become ministers. We become authors, fathers, grandfathers, dentists, doctors, lawyers. That may not be a good thing to become a lawyer, but but just remarkable accomplishments. It's just an incredible story, and I think that's a story that young people ought to know because, you know, young people run into these dilemmas and say, oh, my God, it's all over. It's not all over. It's just beginning. You just got an obstacle and jump over it.
Many thanks to our guest today, Orson Swindle, for sharing his story, and to guest hosts Taylor Keelan and Reagan Wilson. This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by the American Veterans Center and Radio America. Join us again next time for more stories from the brave soldiers who answered their country's call.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.